the cliff system, but we were unable to catch the system to work today, so we'll put that off for another meeting. And finally, although this is a special meeting devoted to budget, a couple of words about the recent announcement from the president regarding the organizational changes. As you know, and many of you have expressed to members of the executive committee, some concerns over the appointment of a new vice president without going through a search, some concerns about the implications for academic affairs. The executive committee had a very frank discussion with the president last week, and I feel very comfortable assuring the Senate that the estimation for the decision to make this organizational change is sound. We, as an executive committee, were reassured that subsequent administrative searches would follow the policy for filling positions with search, and we were reassured that academic affairs is not going to be negatively affected by this move. The executive committee recommended, and President Papazian agreed, to take some time out of this meeting for her to talk to the Senate about the change and answer any questions that you may have about that organizational change and the decision that she made to fill that vice president position. Andy told me that she's in a very important meeting right now. She's running late. So what we'll do is we'll put that at the back of this meeting, and we'll go right into our budget presentation from Vice President Charlie Foss and the finance team. Charlie, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michael. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to try not to use the microphone, if that's okay. Do you want me to use the microphone?
It's talking about
it. And I will use the microphone. Sorry, I like to be a little bit more unstuck. So.
Oh, it's just tape.
We're good. Okay. So this is my first budget presentation. Everything's been published in accordance with what we're supposed to do. It was published last week by Bradley and Josie and the team, as well as we sent out the presentation here, hopefully for everyone over the weekend, so you guys can take a look at it. And if you have any comments and questions as we go through, I'm sure you will not be shy to bring those up. The other thing I'll point out is the Budget Advisory Committee has met a few times so far this year. It's co-chaired with, besides myself, with Steph, and we have a number of folks that are on that committee. Hector sits in, on the student side as well. Each of those folks from that committee were very instrumental in helping me put this presentation together. So that's, I believe, different than what's happened here in the past. You know, this budget is really a coordinated, collaborative presentation in the sense of over the past few months, Andy, Reggie, and I, and our various staffs have met to look at what the priorities are of our campus and to make sure that those high priority items, student success being you know, one of those four pillars, campus security and whatnot, are being addressed with some of the one-time funds that we have. I'm going to get into some unique things that we're starting to do differently here with our budget and how we're looking at it. And I also want to show you some slides on the ever-popular athletics question, so we can look at that as well. So if you wouldn't mind, thank you. So, you know, walking through, the biggest takeaway, besides the things I've already talked about on this slide, is the idea of looking ahead, doing multi-year budgeting. And we had some folks from the governor's office here this morning that we were talking to. It's interesting. The governor's budget, and I might have my dates a little bit off, but essentially, you know, they get the budget for next year, it gets approved like 6 months after we've already started our year. And so the process is really a bizarre one in funding. Typically, when you do budgeting, and this is something that I taught for 12 years on, is you start with a strategic plan, and your budgets are meant to be supportive of your strategic plan. And that's kind of the process that you go, and then you tweak your strategic plan or tweak your budgets as you go. But if you don't know what your funding levels are for the next year or subsequent years, it becomes a very, very difficult process. So what we're looking to undertake here is, how do we predict the future? So how do we get our crystal ball out and look at this thing and, you know, get it so that it's somewhat clear? Because it's a very, very cloudy process of saying, how do we do 2, 3, or 4 years look ahead to do our budgeting? And that way we get a little bit more smoothing when we do these budgets. Because remember, I said to the folks from the governor's office this morning, they hand us occasionally, hand us being the CSU, one-time funds. And if they hand us one-time funds, what do we do with one-time funds? It's a difficult thing, because I can find a unique project, you know, whether it's DMH or it's deferred maintenance or it's some special task force that we could spend one-time funds on. But if I take those one-time funds and I put them towards faculty, advisors, or something that is an ongoing expense, I don't know how I'd pay for that in years 2, 3, 4. If that's not a responsible thing for me as the CFO to be condoning or to authorize. And that's always been the dilemma that this university and, frankly, most of the CSU gets stuck with. So what we're looking to do is say, you know, with our multi-year budgeting, we're going to assume that occasionally, hopefully next year, that we're going to get some extra tuition. We're going to get a tuition increase out of the governor's office. You know, they floated this idea in front of the student folks, and so we'll see if that happens. But we're going to build into this model every other year getting a 2% increase in tuition. We're also going to build into this model, and again, it's, you know, that's every other year. So some years 0, some years 2%, averages 1%. We're not talking about a whole lot of variance here. But we're also going to add in, you know, what's our student growth rate looking like? And so, you know, working with Andy's team and Marna, we're looking at about a 1% authorized attendance increase as we go every year. We've been running it a little bit higher than that, so, you know, we're going to try to model that in. We're also looking at growing our international students, you know, our non-resident students. So we're trying to model some of those things that we're experiencing in real time into this model so that we can look at how we spend that money. And rather than ignoring reality and saying we're not going to have any student growth or we're not going to have any tuition increases, that would stop us and handcuff us from increasing our budget or investing in the things that we need to invest in. So hopefully that's a little bit of a primer for you on, you know, a little bit of how we're looking ahead at this multi-year budgeting. So we spent a lot of time at our budget advisory committee meeting talking about one-time expenditures versus ongoing expenditures, and I gave you the quick overview of that, and really addressing these things that are going on, the forecasting assumptions. Thanks a lot. The way I've typically done budgeting over my career is you look at what's our low case of budgeting, and that's kind of what we've been doing. It's a 1% growth on staffing, you know, on students coming in, 1% growth on students, and it assumes really no growth on anything with tuition increases. Over here, if I look at the blue line, we could say, what's the most aggressive case we could take? Well, we can grow student growth at 2%. We can say we're going to grow our international students at 3, 4, or 5%, trying to get from 10 to 15% where our targets are. We could also assume we're going to have 3 or 4% growth when it comes to tuition increases, because that's probably the amount that's overdue that should be coming the way that we haven't seen in years. What I'm looking to do is more the yellow line that's between these. I don't want to take an aggressive stance, but I want to be moderately aggressive. I want to be moderately conservative, a little bit more than conservative when it comes to this. And it gives us a little bit of flexibility And that's what we saw this year when we were authorizing these student success dollars. When we need to fund these academic advisors, we need to fund the resources so that we can have international students, if that's where we want to get some of our growth from, we got to find ways of supporting that. And so that's why I'm looking at taking this little bit longer range view, excuse me, the yellow line here, and supporting the yellow line on this one. What's important? I talked last time, a couple weeks ago when I was here, you know, it's student success. Clearly, you know, Reggie and Andy have been talking a lot internally, externally about what's going on. This number that's on here is the delta, you know, that was uniquely funded, not the total amount that's going to student success. So Andy funded some of it, and we took some out of one-time funding. Deferred maintenance, we're trying to spend about $2 million a year. And I talked to the governor's staff about this as well today. We have, as you all are well aware, an old and aging campus, all right? And who's my belt person? Where's my belt person from last meeting?
Judith.
Where's Judith? All right, I still have my belt on, okay? But our campus needs a lot of belts, all right? Because it's old, it's not young. And so, you know, there's a lot of deferred maintenance that's needed around this campus. So we're trying every year to set aside dollars so that automatically we're doing this deferred work. One of the things that is one of these myths, and I'm going to hopefully over the course of some time here start debunking some of these myths that are out there, but if you're looking for work to be done, so if you need a new outlet in your office, or you need a new lights over here, or you need you know, something done, if I ask for a show of hands, does maintenance charge you for that? Yes, no? Who says yes?
Yes.
All right, no. All right, maintenance does not charge you for that. All right, and that's been that way for Josie Bradley 2-3 years now, that maintenance, we have, maintenance has money that's set aside for them to do these projects. All right, so if there's, now if you need a new lock on your door, that's a different story. It's a bigger ticket item. But, you know, for some of these small ticket items, maintenance will do these projects for you. All right. Now, it's not how we run on the maintenance guys, but the idea is that we're trying to make sure these, and I view these things as deferred maintenance, that these things will get taken care of and it's not out of your department budgets. And then campus security. So, you know, we're spending money on additional cameras around here, additional police officers here, making sure their wages are right. We're having, oh, by the way, we're having a night walk here, a safety night walk, coming up in a couple weeks, if I mentioned that last time or not, but it's on the 24th at 7:30. So anybody that is available that night that wants to take a walk around campus, we're meeting over in the FD&O building at 7:30, you know, on the 24th. Next slide. I wanted to show, and hopefully these slides, you know, are the high level, because frankly, there's tons of detail if you go through the budget itself. We have a 300 some odd million dollar operating budget. The whole budget for the university is over $600 million. So I wanted to show this operating fund. That's the big one that we were talking about and most people recognize. But we have all these satellites that are going around this operating fund, some of which interact with the operating fund, some of which don't. But there's various monies that are all through here. You add these things up and you get to this $600 million. So, for inclusiveness, I wanted to be able to show all the different things that we have around the campus. Also, some of this money that comes to us in the general fund is, you know, from our operating budget, would be in green on here. Some of it gets restricted, so that becomes in the yellow that's here, and some of it's kind of in between. And so there's lots of different ways, you know, that our money, it's not always green, you know, so it, sometimes it has encumbrances, sometimes it doesn't have encumbrances. So we have a large staff, you know, but frankly, probably not enough if I ask Josie, that has to work these things, you know, and, you know, these aren't always easy to decipher, easy to manage, because we have tons of, I just get a stack of audited financials from all the auxiliaries that we have around campus. So the amount of, the volume of paperwork that goes behind these budgets is pretty amazing. Next slide. So revenue sources, you know, we get the, you know, money from student fees, you get from the state, you know, the student success initiatives, compensation. All right, so faculty got a nice increase this year, maybe it's long overdue increase this year, but that will be part of what goes into these budgets. Next slide. So this is the Andy's Pac-Man chart. So academic affairs being 70% of the overall budget for the university. That number is up from, who's got the number from last year? No, someone has to have it, my guys.
It was 50-something.
No, it was about 65, or 64.
It was 50-something because the university-wide was, I think, about 10 points higher. So something's happened to redistribute the university-wide back into academic affairs.
So I'm not aware of that. Josie, do you have any thought on that? So 64 was the chart I saw from last year.
Maybe it was 2 years ago, it was 55, it said. Yeah. There was this huge university-wide chunk.
So from last year to this year, the two major differences between academic affairs are salary increases that were in there, that's around 3 points. And it was about 3 points for ITS. ITS transferred out of admin and moved it down to academic affairs.
In dollar amount, how much is 100%?
This is the three. This is the operating fund, so it's 334. Okay. So the various pieces of our business here. Next slide. When you look at what do we get to do with that, of all those different units, 75% of what we have is people based. So almost everything we have is people based. You add into that some utilities. And now I'm extremely limited to what the flexibility is that we have. Financial aid is on here. There's not a whole lot we can do. It becomes a 7% sliver that we actually get is the, I'll call it discretionary. And it's, frankly, it's a whole lot less than that 7% that's true discretionary that's in here. So, when I looked at these budgets before I came on board, it's kind of like I got one hand and one leg tied behind my back. There's not a whole lot that we can, in the short term, do to make decisions. Everything we have is really tied up in people. And that's why it's so important when we get funding, we make sure that the funding that we have is ongoing funding. Because if we get this one time and we start investing in these parts of the pie, and then that funding goes away or doesn't come back the next year, we're in a lot of trouble. Next slide. So some of the part of the budget advisory committee wanted to talk about what some of the CSU funded versus our own deferred maintenance things that are going on. So whether we're working on DMH, all right, Dudley Moorhead, that's part of what's going on. And again, that's still on track for January, so don't want to lose sight of that. On campus deferred maintenance, the things that we're paying for, whether it's the roof, whether the engineering building, working on Science 142, some of these projects that are going on, and then the major capital projects. CB2 opened up, I think I said that when I was here a couple weeks ago. It was going to open up, it did open. It's beautiful. It's amazing. The students are thrilled to be in there. As a result of that now being open, we're able to now start the decommissioning of two of the bricks. Royce and Hoover are going to be the first two that right now we're going through, clearing them out, taking the beds, the desks. Some of those things are has usable assets in those buildings, stripping all that down. Working through the buildings in another probably couple weeks those buildings will start the process of coming down. And the reason that's important is the student recreation and aquatic center is going to be going into that footprint, into that area. So it's a $130 million big ticket item that's going to be taking another couple of years before it comes online. But if you haven't seen the video of this, of what's available, it truly is amazing. So at the Student Union, Kathy has it on a reel going what this Student Aquatic Center is going to look like. Real nice. And Michael here? I didn't see Michael. So the science. No.
This Parish Union.
Different one. Science, but different science. So Michael Parrish has been helping lead this effort of getting our new STEM interdisciplinary science building built. All good news. So yeah, we're continuing to move forward with planning on that. And then obviously DMH is much smaller than these dollars, but it's one of our capital improvement projects that we're finishing up. Hang on, just another minute. I almost said the bet one. I almost said the bet one. Next slide. So I have in your package, there's a slide behind each of those bubbles that were surrounding the operating budget. So this happens to be athletics. It talks about revenue sources that are coming in, whether it's from ticket sales or it's from our operating fund or student funds, where it's going to, what some of the highlights are for the business. I tried to do that for each of those groups. So I'm not going to pitch these charts to you because you've seen them in the packet. But I tried to do this for those of you who didn't understand, didn't know. Please take a read through, all right, and you know, follow up with questions. So now what I wanted to show in here, because I'm not sure these numbers have been shown specifically in the past, but here's the past 2 years of athletics budget. And I did not do this for every unit that's in here, but we could. And actually, we moved back and forth at the Budget Advisory Committee. You know, was it appropriate to show this? And I said, hey, you guys, most of the folks I've talked to over the past 4 or 5 months all wanted to see this. That's why we're showing it for athletics. But frankly, we could show it for any of our businesses. What this shows is that 2 years ago, we had a $374,000 deficit in athletics. Last year, we were right on plan. And what it shows is the split between what comes out of the operating fund, that $334 million, versus what's student funded, versus what is raised through donations, ticket sales, sponsorships. So it's just a way of looking at where things are for the athletics budget. Next slide. Then, you know, taking from some counsel from Ken, from some other folks, I wanted to look at comparing us to other people in the Mountain West Conference and, you know, CSU, how much people were spending on athletics. So we're spending, and this is all this data is out of the USA Today. So, you know, this is all public information. This is, you know, it's stuff that we input to USA Today on, and public service announcement here. It's also bridgeable. So the numbers that we have in our budget would be slightly less than this $28 million. It's because the way we account for things here at the university, we have certain expenditures that it makes a lot more sense for us to group together and manage, whether that's facilities, it's benefits, some other things that are going on at the university. We're looking at those things as a separate unit. It's not reported back. We do that for every unit across the university. So $28 million is what we're spending on for 14-15 in the for San Jose State for athletics. San Jose State, San Diego State is just about double, and everyone else is significantly higher than we are in the Mountain West. When you look at it, you know, on a cost per head, you know, we're the, you know, the next to the lowest, next to Colorado, but you know, it's a big difference. And so the takeaways from this chart, you know, either we're massively underfunded in athletics, which is one argument that maybe Gene and some other folks might have. Another is that, you know, why is our revenue so low? And do we have the next slide there, or is that no? Okay, so. You know, what happens is it's really, it comes down to what are the revenues, the ticket sales that are going into athletics. And I'm going to do a test here. Who was at the football game on Saturday? All right. Well, thank you for those who came. Shame on you guys who did not. It was a beautiful Saturday afternoon. It wasn't much good football that was out there, but it was a beautiful day. And the school needs support. All right?
They didn't pay.
I'm sorry?
They didn't pay.
No.
No.
No, but they need support.
So,
It becomes a go-to place. No, but people have a hot dog, or people have a beer, people have a soda. So there are ways, and frankly, sponsors pay when they see butts in the seats. And so that it's important to go out and support. All right. Our athletic budget, we don't have the revenues that are coming in like San Diego. We don't have the revenues that are coming in like Fresno. And so that's one of the problems, one of the biggest problems. It's not a matter of how much is coming out of the budget for the university, because we're lower than every other school, I think, but not by a whole lot. It's really the amount of money that we're raising. And so that's part of what the naming rights deal is going to help close a little bit of that gap. But Gene and his team are looking to find other ways of creating revenue streams to start closing that gap and fund their athletics. So that's the end of my core presentation, all right? But I'm happy to take questions and comments.
Senator Sebelius.
It's not about athletics, actually. I looked at the budget earlier, and when I saw the price for the Student Recreation and Aquatic Center, I saw the M behind the number, but I thought there was a typo. I thought it was really $130,000. So we're paying $130 million for a fancy gym and a fancy pool.
The students are paying for that.
Wow. And that is in comparison to our library that was $177 million a couple of years ago. And the science building.
The science building will be significantly north of that funding by the time we're all set and done. That's the amount of funding that's coming from the CSU going to that.
Okay, is that clear? Yes, I know. Okay.
But at the end of the day, students are in the classrooms for how many hours a day?
Well, 15, I would say.
15, hours 16. A day. No.
A week, right.
So they're in the classroom 4 hours a day, 3 hours a day, right? They're on campus, especially our freshmen, and sophomores, the remaining amount of time. So, engagement on the campus with activities is hugely important, all right? And, if these students are healthy and they're working out in the gym, they're going to be awake during your classes. That's less alcohol that's involved in the process. There's much more positive things that are happening as a result of that.
And that's paid for by associated students' funds?
Senator
Bezanski. I just wanted to, first of all, congratulate you and our provost as well for presenting this budget in a manner that I've never seen before on this campus, and I've been here forever. This is a marvelous way of demonstrating how things really work, and I'm delighted to see it that way.
Thank you.
Then beyond that, I do want to point out that having been here forever, this Senate passed a resolution somewhere in the middle of the 1990s, I believe. A resolution that was a recommendation to the administration not to spend more than 2% from the general fund, what is now called the operating fund, we used to call it the general fund, no more than 2% per year. Now this year, the number is 2.8%.
On athletics,
yes. This year it's 2.8%. And quite often what we find is that whatever number is given for the proposed expenditure, that when the year is up, it's even larger than that. And I would like to urge you and urge the administration to attempt to go back to that 2% figure for athletics, because I think this body could live with that very nicely. We are all pretty much upset about something like 2.8%. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. We will take a look at that. I'm trying to be very transparent with all the numbers that are up here, so I appreciate those comments as well. we'll look at it. You see where we're spending, you know, at the 28 million, and frankly, you see what that's getting us, and you see what the other folks that are in our conference and our other CSUs are spending, and some of the results that they're getting. So I'm not defending, you know, we're the right avenue for that next step is within our strategic advisory committee, our strategic planning committee. So we'll take it there.
Thanks, Shiflett, and then send it to you.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. On page 2, you'll find information regarding faculty compensation increases. And due to the very late final negotiations, campuses are required to fund 1% of the permanent salary increase.
That's right.
So here's my question. This amount comes out of our base budget, yes?
So we had to find money to solve that, yes.
And it's out of the base. And if yes, were there any major changes to the distribution of funds to make this possible?
So this, everything we do, and that's the earlier slide that I showed you, is about trade-offs. So, you know, this is a contractual agreement, you know, so it's a, you know, we have to fulfill the rest of that agreement. So it's a matter of when we had not extra money, the growth of money, something got funded less. So I didn't take away money from anything. Just, we didn't have as much money to put into student success. We didn't have as much money to put into campus security. So, you know, those we would have, if we didn't have to fund that extra 1%, it would have went into those categories.
Okay.
So it's not a matter of I took it from those categories. Subtle difference, right? Right. So it's just those categories got funded less.
You could mention, if I could just add to that, if you don't mind, is when we actually, as a cabinet, discussed resources, we didn't talk about base funding allocations at all.
There was no base funding discussion. There was one time when completely this year in these discussions.
Senator
Sebelius?
Yeah.
Since the chart is still on there, I'm disturbed, like my colleague Senator Buzanski, by the high amount that goes from the operating budget to the athletics division. If I was a student and I sort of identify with them, I'm really, really upset that $8 million of the student funds go to support athletics. Whenever I talk to my students on campus, they don't know how much they pay to support the athletics division. And I don't know why previous AS leaderships have been suckered into this, but I sure hope that with changing AS leadership that would be looked upon again on whether, is that really where you want your dollars to be spent? Now, the total amount of subsidies or contribution from the budget, from the operating budget and the students is 16.5 million, probably a little more. On another chart I see, that's page 7, it's further down, it shows that $1.8 million have been allocated to reduce bottlenecks. When I look at this $1.8 million supposedly fund 353 sections. That means if we had $16.5 million to spend on classes, we can fund over 3,000 classes, 3,000 sections. Now, I was very happy with what President Papasian said in response to my criticism of the funding of the athletics division. She said, for me, athletics is not about win or lose, it's about the educational outcome for the people involved. With that kind of money, it's a question of proportion. Where do we spend that money? How many people are benefited by playing some sport versus, you know, 3,000 extra classrooms filled with 30, 40, 50, maybe 80 students? So this is the question. And this chart, I'm happy to see that, but it's also misleading because these are comparable institutions now. But we chose to move up there. We can also choose to move down. We can also choose to go the Long Beach way that has abandoned football, the CSU Northridge way that has abandoned football. Their funding, their sponsorship has not caved in. there was a little dip for 1 or 2 years, and now it is as steady as it was before. And when we compare ourselves to them, we spend way too much money on athletics. And also our contribution there is a lot higher. As you mentioned, we don't bring in that many revenues. So, and I was also encouraged by President Papasian's response. She says she's willing to engage in a fact-based dialogue. I'm not against the athletics division. I'm not against students being engaged in sport. I'm against the proportion. We can play in a smaller league, and we would equally teach discipline and team spirit and ethics. We would instill them equally into the students without being week after week almost embarrassed on national TVs by being matched up with football powerhouses that we have actually, in my opinion, no business to play with. So, but I'm looking forward to that discussion that the president has promised, and I'm really appalled by the $16.5 million in subsidies that go to the athletics division. And I'm glad I see you take notes, President of AS. Thank you.
Well, a compliment and then a question. The compliment is with reference to page 11 of the printed report, where I note that there is $2.1 million budgeted in deferred maintenance for campus-wide elevator modernization, and my position is, please. Now, the question is one we just talked about in the hallway a little bit. Could you go into the level of self-support at these other universities, in particular alumni donations, and the role they play in helping our comparable institutions have budgets that are so much larger than our own?
So if you're referring to how do they fund their, we fund our 28, essentially, you know, 888, you know, for 8 million of out of the general budget, 8 million out of the student fund fees, and, you know, 8 million otherwise. So when you look at San Diego, their 8 million coming from tickets, you know, their bars of ticket sales and what have you, is more like 22, 23. So it's substantially different, you know, what they're able to do because of the facilities they have, because of the program they've built. Same with Fresno. You know, Fresno is, you know, the Central Valley mecca that everyone goes to on Saturdays for the sports. You know, we don't have that here in San Jose.
Why? You're an expert on this. You have taught about this subject. You probably know more about it than anyone for many years on the history of this campus. Why is it that a Fresno or a Boise or a Colorado State is able to raise lots of money, sell lots of tickets, yet higher licensing fees? And for 25 years, athletic director after athletic director after athletic director tells us we'll do better, and we never do. But what is it about San Jose State that seems to be a barrier to the same levels of success as these other institutions?
So there's probably a couple of things here. Excuse me, but there's no magic, you know, answer, that's for sure. One, facilities. You know, our facilities, you go down to Spartan Stadium, or now CFQ Stadium, it's old, it's dated, it's in bad shape. There's not a whole lot to be proud of there. The folks who were at the game on Saturday, you baked. You know, but I could say the same thing if I flip it. If you went to, on Thursday night, you happened to go to the 49ers game and watched, you know, a similar beatdown, the visiting team beating the local team, you were out there sweating and sitting in those hot seats. So, but they were paying real money to sit out in the 49ers stadium to do that. There's, when you don't have a tradition of winning, and you have to develop that tradition of winning, so you have to find that young coach, you have to find that new way of doing it, and it's hard to do. But and especially when you're a university that's known as a stepping stone university in sports, where you get a good coach, and he or she, depending on the sport, will be here for a couple of years, and they'll look to jump up to the next caliber of class. So you have to place some bets on these coaches when they're relatively young. And that's like athletes. It's a hard thing to do when they're untested, to be placing some bets. So facilities are tough. It's hard to have a good coaching staff when your facilities are not good. It's hard to recruit the best athletes when your facilities are not the best. What we have going for us, and you know, Gene's been to this group in the past and presented it, is the return. So our student athletes are better than most of the other groups that are out here because they are student athletes. So we're not cranking out athletes. We're cranking out student athletes. You know, ones that are graduating, ones that are contributing, ones that are coming back and being teachers. So there's something to be proud of there. If we're not just churning out linebackers to go to the NFL or point guards to go to the NBA. You know, we're actually training up student athletes, and that is the mission, I think, of what we're trying to do. And lastly, I guess, this community is a tough community. When you're down in San Diego, other than the Padres, and this could be debatable, you don't have any pro sports teams, okay, that are down there, right? So, because the Chargers are moving out, so their university is kind of the big sports mecca that's happening there. Clearly, in the Central Valley, that's what it's all about. The sports teams are not in that Central Valley, so that's how they can draw there. Here, you have a lot of options for your entertainment and sports dollar. And, it's all about who's relevant at the time. You know, I worked for the Sharks for 10 years. You know, the Sharks went through a little bit of a downturn, not last year necessarily, but earlier in the year they weren't as good. They weren't selling out. And so people get, fickle with their money. And so they're going to support a winner. They're going to support something that's popular. And we first, because if we don't do it, how do we expect our community to do it? So if we don't support our sports teams, I'm not sure how anybody in the community is going to jump on board either.
I can't resist. I have to ask an athletics question. I was looking at the budget report for this year, and I was actually familiar with the numbers that you mentioned just now about it being 8, 8, and 8. Operating fund, 8 from IRA fees, and 8 from generated revenue.
Right.
And I noticed that in the budget report for this year, unlike the previous at least 5 years, that 8 seems to have shrunk to 5.5. And I believe the reason that it's done so is that the several million dollars of benefits no longer appears on this page. Is that a change in accounting, or is that just a number that's missing?
Joseph, do you have an idea? I'm not familiar enough with
the numbers. So from the benefits are budgeted centrally and university-wide, and then they're allocated as actual benefit costs are done throughout the year. So the net result will be about $8 million of expenditure salary.
Why the change this year from reporting it in the budget compared with, sorry.
It's okay, I understand. But there's just new people in athletics.
So if we included that almost $3 million in benefits, it wouldn't be 2.8%, it would be 3.3%.
No, on the page 8, the benefits are included in that.
Okay.
It's on the athletics detail page, that is not.
Okay.
It would be about 2, I think, without the benefits.
Okay. I'm just alerting people that if you're comparing the athletics budgets from the past several years with now, the budget detail is different than it was the last roughly 5 years at least.
It has gone constantly up.
Yes.
Senator Shepard, you are next, followed by Senator Pansy, followed by Senator Spiker, followed by Senator Rose.
Thank you, Senator Pass. I was going to speak to the IRA dollars, which you've already mentioned.
Thank you.
All right. So much I want to say, so little you want to hear. I appreciate what's going on here. Just like last night, this debate, people are baked in. They've made their choice, and nobody's going to change anybody's decision. And I appreciate that. We're a lot more collegial together than last night's were. But
somewhat, in your heart.
Yeah, somewhat like last night, we're hearing a call for change, and we don't know what that change is going to be. And I don't want to vote for a change if I don't know what that change is going to be. And Romy is very correct that we are very much underfunded, and he's trying to find a way to get us some more funding. And I appreciate that. But he's speaking from the heart. And I'd like to move just a little higher up and get you to think about the following things. That in the worst economic environment that we've seen in our lifetimes, except for perhaps Professor Bozanski, ten universities have taken on, 11 universities, have taken on new FBS football teams. This is the same group that we are in. One has dropped football. They have, that was in 2015. They are trying to get it back right now. It's University of Alabama at Birmingham, and are scheduled to come back online. So it tells you something about those teams. Are they all idiots? Probably not. Trump University has not gotten a football team. So as a result, it kind of makes you wonder what's going to happen. Romy is leading us down to the land of milk and honey and the Elysian fields that we'll be dancing in if we just drop football, as Long Beach did, as Fullerton did. Northridge, by the way, was never in FBS, so it's Fullerton and Long Beach. And so check with your friends. What kind of wonderful funding do they have now that they don't have football that they didn't have before? What kind of benefits really are going to come from this? Because we are funded on a programmatic basis. And you lose the program, you lose the funding. If the College of Business was wiped away, we don't get the funding for the College of Business if it's gone. And so remember, we have to demonstrate, if we want to get rid of something, we have to demonstrate what those benefits actually are going to be. And by the way, athletics is the largest minority scholarship program we have. And those people would be lost without this kind of programming that we are able to generate for them. So I agree with your desire to make the funding better for San Jose State, but I disagree with how you plan to do it.
Senator
Spiegelman. Hello. Okay. Thank you. I'd just like to offer some perspective from student. So I agree with Senator Sebelius that I think athletics are very important and we should not get rid of them. But I am a student who, I don't plan on going to any sports games. I don't plan on joining any athletics teams. I don't plan on using the current recreation facility or the new aquatic center. And I'm sure there are thousands of students like me in the same position. And I just ask that you recognize where we're coming from. And I do want to say that I don't think it's inappropriate to consider the deep cuts to the athletic budget that you're referring to when we're talking so much about these bottlenecks and how we only graduate 10% of students in 4 years. And see, in reference to helping minority students through scholarships, I feel like that money could be used a lot better in closing the achievement gap. And you can give more money to advising, to So yeah, we don't all use sports. It doesn't benefit us all.
So noted, thank you. Note that working with Dr. Blaylock and Andy here, you know, we've worked on, you know, where to fund these achievement gaps. We've worked on the success
pillars of how to fund those and how much we can fund them. Because frankly, you can only fund and staff it so much at a time. So you could throw twice or three times as much money at it, and I don't know if we can hire all those people. So I believe I'm speaking for Ann and Reggie on this, but we are getting awful close to the right amount of funding that they can be spending at this point. And we're earmarking more money in the future for these activities because, yes, that's our mandate, is to have more tenured faculty, to get the students out of here at a faster rate in 4 years, you know, 6 years, but at a faster rate, and closing those gaps between, you know, minority and non-minority gap. There shouldn't be any gap there. So we are funding those programs as fast as we can fund them, and as fast as we can staff them.
And then Senator Caesar, and then we're going to shut down this portion of the meeting.
Thanks very much. Couple of questions. First question, which really comes back to, thank you for your contribution. Have we actually ever asked the students what they feel about funding parameters? And have we surveyed them and asked them whether they think spending $8 million out of their funding, plus $8 million of the general fund, is a good idea?
So the answer is yes. And, you know, the students are the ones that approved the student union, all right, that just opened up. The students are the one that approved SRAC. Okay, the aquatic center. So the students are voting on this, and it might not be all the students voting on it, okay, whether they vote or they'll vote, but a majority of the students are proposing that we need more activities on this campus. You talk to Reggie, and you know, what you need to have is you need to have multidimensional students that are here. You can't just have pure academics. They have to have it's like a work-life balance. And they have to feel engaged while they're here. And if you have students that are living on campus, participating on events, it doesn't mean they have to be athletic events, but participating in events, having a good education, they become great alumni, and they turns around, they start giving to the university. All right, part of our, and this is my opinion here, part of our big issue is that we don't have alums that feel that they got enough when they were here in this campus. And whether that was because they didn't live here, because it was predominantly a commuter campus for years and years, and frankly, it almost still is. And you know, they're getting a good academic education, but they're not getting those other round of things. They're not coming back and giving us money for that. So there has to be this full circle, and we haven't, it's gonna take time. So you've heard this maybe before, but it does take time. And the end result is the alums that are giving. I walk the press box at our game, all right? So you're in that press box, and there were three or four major, I'll say maybe the largest donors that this university has. They were sitting in that press box at the game. To me, that speaks volume that our biggest donors are sitting there watching maybe an average or below average football team, you know, getting beat on a Saturday. But our donors, our biggest donors, are sitting in that stadium. And we need, and frankly, the future donors are some of those other alums that are in that parking lot tailgating going to those football games.
Okay, a couple of follow-up questions. First of all, the numbers that Ken Peter circulated, I think, earlier today, suggested that we are actually subsidizing our athletics program to a much larger extent than the other four institutions that you've got there. So by my calculation...
No, that's not correct.
Well, 18.1 million is the student portion plus the general fund portion out of a total budget of 25. So that comes to about 71%.
So 28, but yes, go ahead.
Okay,
yes.
So the same number, San Diego State is 50%, Fresno is 37%, Colorado is 57%, and we are 71. So about 30% is coming out of the self-support, the ticket sales and other revenues.
Yeah. The way these other units, all these other universities are solving their athletic budgets is by ticket sales and sponsorships and alumni giving. Okay. That's how they're solving.
Okay. So two other quick questions.
What are the lowest as far as the contribution?
Okay. Just so we wrap this up, Senator Caesar, you have a final question?
Hi, I actually have another perspective from a student. I actually have a sentiment similar to Senator Campsie. I think we shouldn't undermine the benefit of the athletic programs. I do think if we're going to have athletic programs of such size, we need to work on building the program now. So maybe some people aren't seeing the benefit of spending more money on it, but I think if you look at how it's impacting students, and if we spend the money now to make it a better program, it'll help the university in the future, from alumni, from funding. Students want to go to schools where they have athletics teams, football programs, and things of that nature. So I think if we focus on maybe spending a little more now, the benefit that we get from that will help in the future. And I do know that not every student benefits from it, but I think a lot of them do. And like the senator was saying, like, there's a lot of students who may not get the opportunity to go to college without these programs. So I think we should, you know, remember that volume.
So thank you very much. I appreciate you guys taking the time, giving the feedback through this process. Hopefully, you know, this is a clearer, more straightforward way of looking at this budget. Work with me, work with Steph, work with our budget advisory committee as we go forward.
We're just going to have a little bit of a brain break here. We do have a consent calendar. Is there any discussion?
We have a couple additions for the consent calendar. We have Roxana Barachi to be added to professional standards, and also Connie Huang to be added to professional standards. And Stacey Gleitzer will be coming off O&P.
Any discussion? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved. President Papazian, are you ready?
Sure.
What we're going to do is, in the interest of time, and our goal is to be done by 4, I'm going to be forward to the president for 20 minutes, and we'll do some time for Q&A, and if there's additional issues that remain, we'll address them offline. So, President.
Thank you. We'll take 20 minutes if you actually want me to take 20 minutes. We don't have to take 20 minutes, but I appreciate it. There's a lot going on. I want to comment on a couple of things today. I want to talk a little bit about the summit that we had on September 30th. We haven't had a chance to talk about that in this group, but this is something that was focused on education and college readiness. It was inspired by Assemblyman Evan Lowe and some conversations that our team had with them, and was really a collaborative effort around the Student Success Initiative between Provost Andy Feinstein and Vice President for Student Affairs Reggie Blaylock and their teams. Some of you were able to be there, others of you were not, but it was, I thought, a really important day on a number of levels. First, San Jose State really stepped forward as the leader in creating an environment where we could talk about our students, our prospective students, about the issues around college readiness in a way that included our community partners, like the Educational Foundation and others, our community college partners. These are very important partners for us, particularly as we think about remediation, developmental education, and how that might look in the years ahead, and also K-12 superintendents. Our keynote speaker for that was Martha Cantor, former Undersecretary of Education, and also a former faculty member and leader at De Anza Foothill Community College. So this was a very, very rich and important conversation. It was based on research questions. We had a number of people talk about some of the research around developmental education. Where were the obstacles along the way in the preparation of prospective students? We focused a bit on mathematics. Eighth grade is a really critical point when we start to see whether or not students going into high school will have completed the necessary mathematics to matriculate and move right into college level courses. We actually stepped back from that and talked about third grade and what it takes, really, when we look at elementary teacher preparation, math readiness, and how we might look at some new models around collaboration in the earlier grades. Assemblyman Lowe was very interested in what he might take away from this in terms of actual legislation, actual bills. And I think we all understand, and some of us have been in other states, where the legislature has actually stepped in and tried to run the universities. I just came from one of those, where our legislature, I think about 4 years ago, actually got so fed up with the higher ed sector that it passed legislation that basically said you're not going to be able to do these developmental courses anymore in the way that you're doing them. Some of you read the Mercury News over the weekend and you saw that Katie Murphy had a long story focused primarily on the community colleges around this question. I actually was surprised that we weren't part of that conversation in the article, because I do think it takes the whole ecosystem of higher education and actually K through 16, not just K through 14. So we really were looking at what we might be able to do in real partnerships. Clearly, this is something that that all of you on the faculty, led by the provost and certainly our vice president for student affairs, coming together as student success teams, will be looking at ways to partner with community colleges in particular. I've had meetings already with the new chancellors of our community colleges, our local community college feeder systems, and we've been talking about some innovative possibilities, but we start with a commitment that we have to put our students first. And so whatever it takes to ensure that students are successful and are college ready, that's what we have to be doing. With the community colleges, that means building some of their dual enrollment programs, where a student in 10th, 11th, 12th grade might take a college level course under the auspices of faculty who are trying to really ensure that they have the skills and knowledge that they need. That this is a partnership between the community colleges and the high schools in particular. The question then becomes, where do we as a four-year university fit into this? How much, when we learn, and the provost can speak more about this, how much money we actually spend on developmental education, and some of you, you know this, many of our students have been a part of this, and how might we use the research that is there that shows that students who take two or three kinds of remediation in their first years, and it prevents them from getting into credit-bearing courses early on, are very have very small chances of actual success. They tend to drop out, they tend to use financial aid, so their resources dwindle, and they haven't actually moved into a credit-bearing program. And so what of that could be done in partnership with the community colleges? We actually share a lot of faculty, often they're in our part-time ranks, where people are teaching here and teaching there the same courses. How could we bring folks together who are actually teaching in both places and build a kind of partnership that ensures a rigor that we want to see, that students who do transfer from the community colleges can move first complete their degrees, because we know when they complete the associate's degree, if they need to go that route for a variety of reasons, then when they transfer to us after completing their associate's degree, they actually succeed in terms of graduation at the same rates that students who start here as freshmen. So there is some really important work that goes on in the community colleges. They think a great deal about this. They're very involved in the research and they're very innovative, and we can partner with them in a meaningful way. The other piece is to reach down into the high schools to make sure that we are not waiting until it's too late. The 4 years, for example, of mathematics, the kinds of things that can be done in 10th and 11th grade, and even in summer, between, say, 11th and 12th grade, or between 12th grade and they're actually beginning their fall semester. We piloted some of that this year with our Spartan Scholars Program, and there's more of that, I think, that we can do. So that was a very, very important day. And I think what I was so pleased about is that San Jose State and our leadership team and many of our faculty who have been involved in thinking about these questions have really stepped up as the conveners and the leaders in this conversation. And I think it's really important that as a university that we really take ownership of that. We are actually the only major four-year university, public university in this region, and we also have We started, we recall, a very robust college of education that is preparing many of the teachers. So we have a stake in those teachers. We have a stake in continued professional development of those teachers, continued professional support. That has been uneven as I've learned more about it. When we've had a little money, we've done some. And we have these conversations with some of the superintendents. But this actually should be something where we're always in partnership with our K through 12 environment, so that we continue to provide that support, many of whom are in fact our graduates. And then finally, to see, to ensure that we are at the table when legislation is drafted. This is really important because the worst place we can be is for legislators to draft legislation that impacts us and our curriculum and our programs without us being at the table actually informing it. And so we understand that when we don't take care of some things, legislators will step in because they are hearing from their constituents. And so they want to make a difference. Remember, they have to show something because they want to be reelected, or at least they want to be reelected up through their term limits. And so, well, that always does change it, though, I think. So I think it's important that we be at the table for this, that we build those relationships, that we have a great deal of expertise, professional expertise on this campus in a number of areas, in content areas, in education, and in academic student success areas. And so when we have legislators do it, and the Glazer bill is just one example of that, they're not thinking always about all of the unintended consequences on our campuses. What happens to all the other students? What are the additional costs that are embedded in that? But if we can actually be at the table recognizing there's a problem, it has to start with that, and saying that we're not afraid to change, that we want a partner, that it takes all of us at the table to make good and positive change, and in every decision that we make, we keep the students and student welfare and student success at the core. If it makes more sense for a program that we've been running to be addressed at the community college because it's more effective, then we should support that because the impact should be on what students need. And if it starts with students, then the territorialness and all of that needs to go away. Let's stay focused on the students. And different students need different kinds of things. There's plenty of work for all of us. So let's collaborate and let's work together on that. So I just wanted to share that with you because I don't know, I know many of you knew about it. I know some of you were there for part of the day. But I thought this was a very good moment for San Jose State. And it's the kind of thing I hope that we will continue to do, whether it's in the field of education or in other areas, to ensure that we are providing leadership going forward. So let me just pause on that for just a moment. I have one other issue I do want to raise or tell you about, but I do want to give a minute or two if there are some questions on this. Yeah, Romy.
I agree with you. We have to sit at the table, but I want to let you know that the statewide academic senate was at the table. We have a fiscal and governance committee, and they were in contact with the legislators in Sacramento, constantly were lobbying for improvements in that bill, and we hopefully made it slightly better, but we had only so much pull. So we did our part, but if the university leaders would also be there, in addition to our chancellor, I totally agree with you, but we were there.
Well, and I thank you for that, and I think that had a positive impact. And you know, that's a great reminder because when we talk about system-wide issues and Sacramento issues, we have a number of avenues to address issues. And certainly our statewide academic senate, which really does understand the campuses because it's made up of faculty from across the campuses, all different kinds of campuses, I think is really helpful because partly what you are able to do, and I think this needs to be said, unlike an individual institution that might live in a certain context, the statewide academic senate actually addresses those implications across all our different kinds of campuses. Some are very residential, others are even more commuter than we are. Some are very urban like us, others are very rural with a different environment, with different relationships perhaps with their schools. And so I think that's wonderful. And I hope that going forward we continue to have these multiple avenues to have impact and that we pull all in the same direction from different perspectives. So thank you very, very much for that. And we are lucky here at San Jose State to have some really great representation on the statewide Senate as well. So I appreciate that to you and your two colleagues who are also here. Anything else? Another question or comment on this? Andy or Reggie, did you want to make a quick comment real fast or on the summit?
Yeah, it was fabulous. It was just the first step. It's not the last. I think, in fact, I'm looking at today the notes from those meetings that we'll be sharing with those that participated in the afternoon session, but they'll also be made available publicly. Our goal is to have another meeting sometime in January to reconvene that group with additional participants, as really, I think, try to address, as you said, the issue of college readiness, kind of as a collaborative process across basically, preschool, we were talking about even, but preschool through 12th grade and also the community colleges and the universities. We're getting a lot of attention in the press. You saw that today with Katie Murphy's story, but it's also being discussed in the system as well as nationally. It's something that has to be addressed. I mean, we're doing, I think, a lot better job with college readiness at this campus. Just a few years ago, almost, I think, 45% of our students came here needing remediation. Now we're at 29% this year. So a lot of headway, there's a lot of work has been done, but that should be zero. I mean, we should be admitting students here that are ready to go to college and don't spend that first year losing traction on a four-year degree. And we're committed to that. We want to make sure that occurs.
And we want to do it in a way that maintains our accessible access mission. So we don't do this by closing people out of an opportunity, but by making sure that they're ready to really take advantage of it. Real quick, Reggie, just a minute. Yeah.
The other piece was the relational piece. Most people in the room didn't know each other. A lot of new people in the region, from community colleges, K-12s, just didn't know each other. So that piece of folks getting a chance to know each other. The other thing was there was no finger point. Think about K-12 is not doing, or community colleges not doing. It was about how do we do it together, and that was the other important piece.
Thank you. And just to close this part of the discussion, we look forward as these weeks and months unfold, really sharing, and this will be done through the provost and the student success team, what some of the outcomes, next steps will be. So I just wanted to make sure that we're all pulling in the same direction. So thank you for that. Another issue that I just wanted to raise or talk to you about, because it was a discussion we had in the executive committee last week, and I wanted to make sure that we were really clear on how appointment transpired. I want to introduce Jay Bailey in the back. Jay, just raise your hand. Some of you have met her, some of you have not. She's, you can stand up. All right, there she is. As she joined us on Monday as our VP for Organizational Development, Chief of Staff. The push here was really the Chief of Staff role. We were making a transition to have full-time leadership in the Student Success Initiative, and so Stacy Gleixner stepped over there, and we had a number of issues that we needed to address organizationally, as well as support for me as Chief of Staff. There was some questions that emerged, and we had a robust discussion in the Executive Committee, but Michael and I talked, and I said, I wanted to just make sure I gave it a chance to explain it, because I understand some of you were worried that somehow we deviated from Senate policy, and whenever there's a vice president level, there's a sort of process on this campus that we go through and all of that, which I understand readily. I did want to just say in this case, it's not a full vice president, it's a chief of staff. And so it sort of fell in this betwixt and between kind of space where it wasn't clearly one or clearly the other. And so we all agreed on one avenue if it was just the chief of staff, and then there was this other model if it was a full vice president, except it didn't actually fit into that. And so given the nature of the chief of staff piece, I elected to go ahead and move forward on an appointment with somebody who I had worked with for 4.5 years, who I managed to persuade to come out here. I actually didn't know if she would come. Michael can attest to that, because she was coming out to visit, and some things happened. We just realized that there were some needs here as I started to uncover some of the issues that we've seen in the newspapers and other places. There's a certain urgency about addressing certain issues. The one organizational change that I made, and that was in the memo that we sent out, was to bring HR under Jay's purview, as well as the personnel side of faculty affairs. The academic piece of faculty affairs, which is your sabbaticals, your RTD process, your faculty development, all of that lives in the provost's office and is under the provost's purview. That is not under the office of the president. It has no place in the office of the president, and we don't ever anticipate it being there. And I wanted to make sure that was very, very clear. But what has become clear to me in just the few months I've been here, and I've heard a lot from a lot of people, because let me just tell you, we've had lots of investigations, we've had lots of issues. You've seen the tip of the iceberg in the press. I can assure you that there's a lot more, which I can't speak to. But this is a really serious issue on our campus, and it's an issue of having multiple places in charge of multiple things that are not talking to each other, not because anybody doesn't want to talk to each other. It just, the silos are very deep structurally, and because of that, we were falling all over ourselves with inconsistencies, people not knowing what was going on. It makes sense to me that this is an area where we're very vulnerable, and it's important to bring all that under one roof. And at the end of the day, it was my considered judgment that that belonged in the office of the president, because ultimately these kinds of personnel matters and these kinds of investigations, ultimately I'm accountable. And so if I'm accountable, I need to have oversight, and that has not always been the case at the institution, to the detriment, frankly, of the institution. And so in this very narrow way, we brought certain things under. At the same time, but not under Jay's purview, but in collaboration, we also have the Office of the of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, to which the Title IX officer reports to the new director. And that Title IX officer, Natalie Potts, just started on Monday. She's about 3 months too late, to be honest with you. We needed her here all along. Kathy came at the end of July and has been doing two massive full-time jobs with a lot of activity. More activity, as I say, than you will realize. Natalie is here now, and that's going to take a tremendous pressure off of Kathy and allow her to do the work she needs to do around diversity issues, inclusive issues, and all of that. And so now we've got all of this under the office of the president. It's not a power grab by the president, trust me. But this is a way of making sure all of these issues around personnel, around discipline, around investigative processes, around Title IX, around diversity issues, which are very important and very sensitive, kind of live under the same space so that they can be, aligned, discussed, and inform each other in a meaningful and helpful way. Hopefully this will lead us to a process and clarity that we will then be able to share. One of the things I did want to address, because there was some concern expressed by your Senate leaders about exactly how this was going to work on the faculty affairs side, and I get that. What I said to them, and I want to say this to you, is that a model that might have worked in a different institution that we're used to may or may not fit in that way in this institution. And it's important to me, I think, and Jay and I talked about it, and she's met already with the faculty affairs folks and with the HR folks. It's really important to understand what's going to work for this institution. And so we have certain approaches that we want to ask questions about, but honestly, I think it's probably going to take the semester in a very thoughtful and inclusive way to really understand how this flow works and what makes sense and what we're really going to kind of ensure is entirely within academic affairs, and what piece of it, which may end up being a fairly small piece by the time we're all done, will end up in under the Chief of Staff Vice President's purview. So I think it's prudent and wise to kind of give something a little time, let the people involved in it who know the processes, the histories, the traditions, the expectations, right, really work with it together, and collectively they will come up with a model. And once that's clear and more clear, I think we'll be able to share that more explicitly with the campus. But I think sometimes it's really important to have clarity, and sometimes we have to live in a little ambiguity to make sure we're not imposing something on an institution where a different solution or slightly different solution might actually ultimately make more sense. So I hope that covers the issues that we had raised, and it was, as I say, a very robust conversation. But I did want to be absolutely transparent about it. The only final thing I would make is I do see this position as very unique, and as we talk, and we will be talking about some other, possible, positions that we might want to, that are vacant. We've got some now. We might want to move in some slightly different directions. Obviously, that's in the full conversation of our Senate leadership and national searches and all of that. I ran a lot of national searches for every cabinet level and every dean of our institution. That's what I do. But this had a different urgency and a different mix that just didn't quite fit into that model, which is always my reaction. And I would also say, by the way, everyone I ran was chaired by a faculty member, and I just want to reiterate that. So I'm happy to take a question or two if there are some.
Yes, President Fazian, you've answered this to my satisfaction, but just so the Senate can hear, is it your intention that the authorization... Well, you've answered this to my satisfaction, but so the Senate can hear the answer. Is it your intention that the authorization, distribution of faculty lines, those are part of the academic side of the house, and those will continue to operate through the provost and academic affairs?
Absolutely. That goes without saying. You, by the way, I should just remind everybody, you're talking to a former provost. So I do get it, and that's where it belongs. These are academic decisions. The only question that might not be an academic one, is a budgetary one, is the actual authorization of funded lines in terms of sort of a total amount. Because that's ultimately a budgetary issue and consultation with the provost, the VP, F&A, and all of that. But once we've allocated and we said we can fund so many lines, we're out of that business, and that's entirely under the purview of the provost.
Can you shed any light on the
Mike.
On the Hugh Gillis episode, whatever that is?
Can you shed any light on that?
No, I actually... Don't know what that is.
But my question.
Can anybody help me here?
My question arises from the fact that there's a letter to the editor in today's San Francisco Chronicle from an African American student who complained about some hate leaflets in Hugh Gillis Hall that specifically targeted black students. And you know, that's all I know.
I didn't see the letter to the editor, so I may not. This may not be the one, but there were some flyers. Was it the Asian students against Black Lives Matter? Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe that was it. And all I know is that, and it was written in a language that we, you know, wasn't written in English. Most of that, as far as I know, and I know Kathy is working on that. And there's a follow-up to try to understand, working with the UPD to try to see where that came from. It seems to be a non-affiliate, somebody from outside the campus who may have gone through and put up a few flyers. But I know UPD is working with the Diversity and Equity and Inclusion Office, and where they are in that process of trying to understand what happened, I don't know, but I know that we took those down immediately. Was there any, I think that was, anyone else on that? Yeah. Okay. You want to?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll leave it to you.
Okay. I'll move on. We do have a special report. So after the affairs budget, Andrew Marner is going to do the...
I'll start. You can keep asking questions. You can knock another 20 minutes and I'll...
No filibuster in this Senate.
Well, first, I want to start by saying that during the entire discussion of faculty affairs, academic personnel, human resources, Mayor and I were talking about this from the very beginning. It wasn't something that was being done in a vacuum. There was lengthy conversations about it. In fact, something that I was and still am very in support of, particularly when it comes to communication and some of the challenges that we're having communicating across lines, I think that was very important, and that's a way to address it. And it's not a finished product. As I think the president said, there's lots of work still to be done, but I think we're on the right path of addressing ways in which we can more effectively work faculty affairs and human resources together in the future. So I think it's a great path we're moving forward on, and I look forward to improved communications between those units in the future. So many of you have probably already seen, and you can probably, I guess you'll be my mouse. So you probably have already seen the packet, the large document that goes over our academic division of budget plan, but I'm just gonna focus on some of the highlights and the priorities. And as many of you know, we're focusing on student success, faculty tenure density, diversity, RISCA, and staff development. And continuing from last year, student success is certainly our primary priority. And as such, we're devoting considerable resources to student success.
And as I've said many times, and I see, is Reggie still here? Yes, he is in the back. Reggie and I have spent a lot of time in the last 2 years on our four pillars of student success plan, and a lot of the resources you're going to see today that are being focused on that are from that work. And I'm hoping at this point, all of you have read the four pillars plan. Is anyone brave enough to raise their hand and say they have not read the plan? Anybody? I have four copies of the plan with me. So if you'd like to have a copy of the plan, please let me know. But please, if you haven't read it, I think it's very important that you do, because it is a work in progress. And if there's things that you'd like to contribute or discuss about that plan, I'm certainly very eager to hear from you. Please, the next slide. So the CSU's graduation initiative 2025 is in full swing. And up here are our original goals. We have a new set of revised goals, and you also see the projections where we're going to finish out this year. Although I think census is now for another month, Marna, to true up these numbers. But actually, I think we're going to even be looking a little bit better. You know, the focus, as you all know now, is no longer just on six-year graduation rates. It's our frosh four-year rate we really need to focus on, and eliminating the ERM achievement gap. So what you can see here is that we were doing a pretty good job of moving the frosh six-year graduation rate. In fact, our original 2025 goal was 57%, and we're going to be well over that at 61%, maybe even 62% by the time it's all said and done. But our new goal now is 71%, 2025. So those are students that are starting here in 2 years. And so you can imagine we've got some work to do there. But what's most concerning for me, but I think it's attainable, but certainly there'll be some work to do, is a four-year frosh graduation rate. Our original goal was 17%. We're not doing well at 11%, which to many of you in this room is unacceptable. But our new goal is 35%. So those are students starting when? 2021. So we have a lot of work to do in the next couple of years to ensure that 35% of our students graduate in 4 years, beginning in 2021. It's ambitious, but I certainly think that it's attainable. Another thing that you'll notice is our ERM gap. Our original goal was 6 points. We're at 11 points. We were 17 points last year. But the goal is the complete elimination of the achievement gap. And I think it's the right thing to say. All of our students should be graduating in a timely fashion. And so we're going to put a lot of effort and energy in addressing the achievement gap. Now, this was brought up, I think, just briefly, the Glazier bill, right? That's SB 41. Are you folks familiar with that? 412. I missed that. Sorry, it's 412. And that requires all campuses at some point to provide priority registration, academic advising, and progress monitoring for students who complete at least 30 units per semester. That means that they're going to graduate in 4 years, as long as they maintain GPA standards, and they're going to provide us with no additional funding to do that. And the law requires CSU to select 8 campuses to participate in this program at the freshman level and 15 at the transfer level by the start of the 17-18 academic year. And the CSU is going to select another 5 campuses for transfer level participation by 18-19. And the heart of the promise is that students complete 30 units per year, and we're already focusing our efforts to increase average unit loads. So we're not sure yet whether it'll be in that first cohort, but I certainly want to be. The challenge and question that we have to ask ourselves is, and we don't know, is what does priority mean? I mean, at some point, and I was meeting with the Department of Finance this morning, and they were asking questions about this as well, but at some point, everybody is on priority registration. And what does that mean? If everybody's on priority registration, who is being left out? So you have to be very thoughtful about what priority registration means and how it's actually impacting all of our students, and not leaving a set of students out of that process. But I think it's important that we look at, and what's just in a couple other slides, you know, what our average unit load is and where it needs to be for us to graduate in 4 years. Right now we're at about 12.73 average unit load, and what do we need to graduate in 4 years? 15. So there's lots of repercussions from a resource perspective and elsewhere for us to get there. Next slide. So let's talk about how we're actually funding things that are exciting in the student success realm. We invested $5.3 million this year with majors, as I said earlier, support going to clearing bottlenecks and advising. And we're funding up to an additional 500 course sections to relieve course bottlenecks. And I heard Romy make the comment about 353 additional sections. And that's how many have been identified now. We're still sitting on $1 million of resources, and we're speaking very closely with the deans as well as department chairs to identify any more classes that need to be addressed as far as bottleneck or concerns. You go to the next slide. Now, all requests for additional sections was funded, and we're going to do even more next year. That's our plan, particularly since we have a little bit more lead time for planning. You can go back to slide six, go backwards once if you don't mind. There you go. And as many of you heard about our advising, we are at, what's our student to advisor ratio on this campus? 1,850 to 1. We're planning right now, in fact, Martin, I think you might have sent out the note today to the deans, allocating the hiring of 20 staff advisors across the campus, and that will bring our ratio to 1 to 860. Plan to hire 10 more, and that'll bring us down to 1 to 600 advisor to student ratio, which is where we need to be. That's where we should be. And it's going to take us a couple of years to get there. We're also fortunate, as many of you know, to receive $2 million from the Corrett Foundation last year to focus on a student data warehouse. And the warehouse is going to provide real-time access to data. So many times when some of you have asked us for specific information about where our students are, what they're doing, specific characteristics of colleges, Scott runs a report for you, right? What our plan is to have that real-time so you can also run those reports and do the analytics yourselves. And that's a significant investment from the campus, but we're making progress there. We're also under the umbrella of college readiness, expanding writing support, especially for international students. And that's actually in play right now. You'll see that in a little bit as well. And we're also establishing a Dream Center. We've been working on this for a number of years, but Reg and I have identified a combined total of $300,000 to fund the center. We're working right now on identifying space. Looks like there's some options, even the library. I know they've been working and discussing that. We're very close to having actually a physical space for our DreamAct students. And for those of you who don't know, we have over 600 Dreamers on this campus. And it's important they have a space of their own, and we're going to work on that. On the next slide, please. You know, many of you have heard me talk about for a long time tenure density. This year alone, we hired 68 faculty members. And that is a record in the CSU. In fact, somebody brought it up at the provost meeting I had last week. So we hired more faculty members than any other CSU campus in the system. We've hired more than 125 new faculty members in the past 2 years, and we're planning on hiring an additional 64 next year. That sounds great, right? The challenge is making progress in the tenure density number. So last year, hiring 64 faculty members, we increased our tenure density by 1 point. This year, with the hiring of 68 faculty members, we're hoping that we've increased the tenure density by another point. I would love us to get to 60% tenure density. I think all of us would. What's it going to take for us to get there? We have to hire 75 faculty members a year to get there. The challenge we're having is attrition. I was asking Marta this question earlier. Last year, I think we netted 58 faculty hires. How many actually do you think we increased as far as number of faculty members here total? What was the number, Marta?
13.
So 58 sounds great. You know, 10 to 15 additional net faculty is not good. We've got, and I think I joked at this at a last meeting, the first policy I'm going to implement is no one's allowed to leave. They can't retire. They can't take jobs for more money in Iowa. But we really have to do some work regarding tenure density. And it's discussions I'm having with the cabinet, having with the president, and having certainly with Charlie and the other cabinet members. You can move to the next slide, please. So risk and professional development are also a top priority for the division and the campus. And we've allocated just in the division $584,000, bringing our total support for RISCA to $1 million again this year. And our plan is to continue investing significant resources in RISCA across the campus. And besides just the $1 million in RISCA support, many of the staff members today received an email identifying another $100,000 professional development program for staff. So it was well received last year. In fact, I was joking with Marna. I know that we all appreciate the $1 million we're investing in RISCA. I get more thank you letters from the staff over the $100,000 that we give for professional development than anything else. I had a stack, it must have been 20 thank you letters from staff appreciating the work we're doing for them. So I will definitely keep that up. Next slide, please. Other improvements include classroom spaces. How many have seen Science 142? Michael Kaufman, that Michael, have you walked through there? What do you think?
It's nice.
It's nice. We've done a lot of work on that. How about BBC 032? Sweeney 100? So we're doing work on these classrooms. They're looking great. We're investing another $400,000 for planning for next summer. And if you haven't looked at the Purpose website, we have a minimum standards document. We plan to get all of our classrooms up to a minimum standard in the next couple of years. I think there's a lot of work still to be done, but we're certainly focused on that. You've heard of the OneBase system. We're trying to go paperless. How many of you are tired of signing? I get a lot of forms. Many of you don't. I know the department chairs are raising their hands. Working very hard, basically making all those forms electronic. We're working on a new SOAT system that's more reliable. That's also coming online as well. Move to the next slide. I also want to mention, obviously, with IT services, the work that we're doing. You can see we've invested in imaging system replacements and also a web portal. So some of the discussion I've had with the president, besides just a web portal, is we need a mobile presence as well. We're working on that, but we are investing, obviously, in IT infrastructure, too. So last slide for me. And so you can see we've allocated $7 million this year toward a vision for our priority initiatives. And most of the funds come from the university. But the division also allocated $1.7 million from CarryForward, and we also received $600,000 from the Correct Foundation from a gift. I'm going to now hand over the microphone to Marty, who's going to talk a little bit about enrollment planning as well.
Hi, I'm Marty Genis. I'm the AVP for Academic Budgets and Planning. I just wanted to talk a little bit about enrollment funding and the college budget model. As you know, we started the budget model a couple of years ago, and it's been very successful, and we're continuing it. And so this is just kind of a highlight of the enrollment numbers. I hope I don't put you all to sleep. But our FTES target this year is 26,411 for all students, and that's about 1,000 more than we had last year. But at the same time, we are planning to keep our headcount students at the same level. So about 700 FTES of this 1,000 growth is due to our effort to increase average unit loads. So it's actually teaching the students we already have more. And I didn't put it in the slide, and I should have, and that's the resident target. It's at 104.3 now in this enrollment plan. So what do we do with all that money that we receive for enrollment? $4.1 million went to the colleges per the college budget model for instruction. We have $1.8 million tied to the 353 sections that are for clearing bottlenecks. And we have also a reserve of $1 million that we're holding in the division for enrollment issues and bottleneck support, further bottleneck support. For the first time this year, since we've had the new budget model, we were able to carve out some funds to give to the colleges for staffing and operating expenses and equipment. That's what OE&E stands for. We also had a little piece in there, $75,000 for course support. So we appreciate that there are needs outside of just instructors in the colleges, and we're trying to begin to address some of those on an annual basis. And about $200,000 went towards the academic support units outside of the colleges. Some of you might remember when I was here last time, I talked extensively about the induced course load matrix, which is a data-driven prediction model that we use to distribute FTES across the colleges to determine how many each college is going to teach each year. And that starts with inputs to the ICLM, our headcount majors. So this chart just shows you the change in headcount majors from last year to this year. And you'll see that everybody had some growth in there, but I wanted to point out business pulled back a little bit this year. They felt they were a little over-enrolled last year and not able to meet, you know, all the demand they could for courses. So they pulled back a little bit, so that's intentional. And I also wanted to point out that the undeclared students, you know, we've been working on We've been working on reducing a pool of undeclared students called assigned to undeclared. We're perfectly happy to continue to have students apply as undeclared, but we had a mechanism in our enrollment, our admissions practices that would keep the students who were trying to get into really popular programs, we'd offer them admission as undeclared students. And that pool has been, we haven't had tremendous retention in that pool, and it's also been difficult, it will be difficult to get those students through on 4 years when they want to. And so we're trying to be more honest about that and limiting our enrollment in, through that mechanism. So when you run, when we ran ICLM with those headcount majors, this was the result. You'll see it's a little bit different. So while everyone had some growth on the headcount majors, except for business, the FTES that came out of ICLM was different in many cases. And that's because this takes into account all the interplay between the colleges for teaching each other's majors. So I would expect that humanities and the arts suffered a larger drop and the College of Business because we are reducing those assigned to undeclared students. So then the next step in the budget model is that we take those FTES that were determined by ICLM, sorry for all the acronyms, and we fund the colleges using a marginal cost of instruction. This was determined by, we had a consultant come in and help us out and run all the numbers in our data to determine the actual cost of instruction in each one of the colleges. And we remeasure this every year. It has not been any higher than this for any of the colleges, though, in recent years. And that's, it's partly because of the tenure density and the issue that Andy was just talking about, keeping up with attrition. So it will go up in the future, we expect, but it has not yet. I just want to point out that 2,600, the resident surplus students are funded at $2,600 instead of the marginal cost of instruction. So in the next slide, you see that the net budgetary impacts, and we, I think for the last couple of years I've been here, it's been a positive for all of the colleges. This year we had some reductions, but in the end, with the bottleneck funding, which was in addition to this, everybody came out ahead. So everyone had more money to work with this year than last year in order to work on the bottleneck issues. And then I just wanted to touch a little bit more deeply on the special enrollment plan that we've engaged this year and plan to use again next year. We're trying to hold headcount students constant. We are increasing average unit loads, and the way we're doing that is we've removed the caps from FTES limits in the colleges. So in the past, we had to monitor those very closely in order to stay within our resident target assigned by the chancellor's office. And we've received a special dispensation to go beyond that and try and move the needle on our average unit load and increase four-year graduation rates. So our goal is to move the average unit load from 12.4, which is what it was in fall 2015, to 13.1. And in the next slide, just a little teaser comparison to get us all really motivated to increase average unit load. This is San Jose State compared to Monterey Bay, four-year graduation rates. This was for the fall 2009 cohorts that came in, the freshman cohorts. As you can see, the blue lines in this chart show how many students took 15 or more units. And the magenta lines are 12 to 14 units. So you can see that Monterey Bay already has a culture of taking more units, and their four-year graduation rate is 21%. Ours that year was 9%. So this is clearly the biggest factor or point that we can change in order to improve our four-year graduation rates. And then how are we doing on our average unit load on increasing it? This is the whole enrollment cycle from start to finish for fall. So when we opened up advanced registration all the way to preliminary census, and we started out strong, we were all really excited in the first week, and then we kind of got flat, and then it kind of came back, but not as much as we wanted. The dotted line at the top is what we wanted to achieve. This is, we achieved 12.7, as Andy said. We wanted 13.1. So we're going to continue to focus on this going forward. The greatest place we have for change in the next slide is with our new students, because with our continuing students, especially the ones who are in their fourth and fifth year, it's going to be hard to change their, you know, their whole mindset about how many units to take. So it's really going to be important for us to work with our entering classes, and they were very successful this year through the orientation teams in getting that message out, and the new students coming in have much better average unit loads this year than last year, as the slide shows. And you can see the continuing students didn't go up very much at all. So we have work to do there, but they're going to be a harder group to move. And then the last slide is just a slide showing the new monies in the division and kind of the major places they came from. This is our base budget now, so it's not all the extra one-time dollars we have. And you'll see that the biggest adjustments were because of compensation adjustments, $7 million, enrollment funding, $3 million, and then other adjustments includes the ITS move into academic affairs. They had like a $7.5 million budget, and then EOP moved from academic affairs to student affairs, so the net differences. Plus, we have the last year of the EDD program funding, too. They have now achieved their full three cohorts, and the program is fully funded. Okay. Questions for us?
Well, Provost Feinstein, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your priority on improving the faculty hiring rate. Some of the newer senators here may not remember the bad old days when your predecessor had to beg the president to hire 32 in 1 year, which was way below replacement rate, or some of the other years when we were down at 10, I think 1 year at zero. And the result of that has been this erosion of our faculty, senior faculty in particular, and we're going to be paying the price for that for years, and our ability to staff RTP committees, so forth and so on. So it takes someone with some leadership to put resources into the future, and this is the future of this campus, so thank you for that priority. I can't stress that enough.
Ken, I appreciate the comment. I will add one cautionary tale that we need to work on as a campus, besides just hiring faculty. And I know you're working on this, but it's also about diversifying our faculty members. And I've mentioned this before, last year, out of those 68 faculty members, we hired one African-American faculty and three Chicano Latino faculty members. We need to do more.
Can you clarify where we are with respect to financial aid in summer and winter sessions? It sometimes becomes a mechanism for people to stay up with 15 units a semester without doing 15 units in a semester.
I know there's an effort going on in Washington, and actually President Pazzi might know more about the status of that, because they're trying to bring back year-round Pell, so that Pell would be able to be used in the summer again. We're exploring, and it's going to take some creative thinking on this campus, about how we can also offer some completion grants in the summer, so that students who just have one, maybe two more courses to complete, could get a grant and finish in the summer. So we have an uphill battle there in terms of CSU fiscal policies, but they've asked us what we need in order to facilitate this graduation initiative, and that's going to be at the top of our list.
Thank you. Just real quick, I'll say in terms of the year-round Pell, it's very much on people's minds in Washington. We thought we actually were moving in that direction on a bipartisan way, but right now everything is stopped in Washington. So we'll have to see if this comes back in the lame duck. To the other issue, there is an effort right now, and again, the Academic Senate statewide is involved. I know CFA is involved. The students are involved in securing some additional funds for the CSUs this year. And the idea on that is to really focus on those students who are very, very close, so that we can move them, you know, to use some of those additional dollars to really help those students over the finish line. Because that will be a very positive move for all of us.
And to add to that, we received approximately $2 million of the $35 million on this campus to address that. And the discussion was, how do we move students that are graduating in 4.5 years to 4 years, and what can be done to support them? We have not had discussions at the cabinet level of how those resources will be used, but we will shortly.
Commissioner Bellis?
I love money, that's why I talk a lot in the budget meeting. I promise I won't monopolize other Senate sessions that much.
I won't let you.
Thank you. And to prove you that I'm not a one-trick pony, I have a question that's not concerning athletics.
Is it a good
actual question? It's a yes. It's an old issue, but I bring it up because we got new people. We got Vice President Vass, we got a new president, and it's a lottery funds. I sat on a commission as a faculty member to distribute lottery funds when we had President Caret over here in the 1990s. The lottery funds were fairly new then. They came from the state with clear legal provisions that these lottery funds are not supposed to be used for ordinary, regular university budget expenses, but on top of those for extra projects, for things that there couldn't be any funds found in the normal budget. And in the old days, this committee that I was on, we distributed them to faculty development, for faculty members who couldn't get funded by their departments to go to conference, etc. We had a faculty mentor program, and the university also got a chunk. Now we have $2 million lottery funds, and the number stayed fairly constant for the past years, and we give 1.9 of these millions, 1.9 to the university library funding. And the university library is part and parcel of a university. That you cannot tell me that this is not in the regular expenses of the university. And there was a strange transition. While it was the faculty funds were faculty controlled, one interim provost hijacked them. He just took them over and rolled them over into his budget. And we had hoped that when we have a leadership change, we would get these funds somehow back out of your pool, so to speak, back into faculty control. And since then, I've brought it up many times. I still think it's illegal. Yes, are you going to distribute the lottery funds as the legislators have envisioned it?
The way I look at this, Romy, and it's true, I think of the 2 million, almost all of it goes to the library.
Yeah.
And that was a campus decision that was made at a number of campuses across the CSU many, many years ago. But what I can tell you is the way in which resources are managed in our division. Not that all money is green, but in this case, we use those monies to support library initiatives. But if there are initiatives that are not being supported in our division, I'd like to know about that. In what ways would you like to see those resources being utilized to support the faculty? For instance,
how long
we're spending,
do you want?
Well, I'm just saying we're spending $1 million right now for research. We're spending, as we just saw, over $5 million in student success. We're hiring 68 faculty members. We're investing resources in advising. So, not that it's a shell game, but if we were to move those resources to do something else, obviously with the limited resources that we have, one of those other priorities would also be affected. So if it's a question of how those monies are being spent or what priorities are not being funded, maybe that you and I can have a conversation about that. Because certainly I'm open to and willing to listen to needs of this division. That's my responsibility. So if there are priorities or needs in this division that are not being addressed, let's look at it from that perspective versus seeing how particular funding models are not being used in a particular way. Is that fair?
Thank you for your presentation. Can you hear? Oh, thank you for your presentation. It's very helpful. In the last couple days, I talked to two students who had three jobs so that they could go here. And they really can't take 15 units a semester. So I wanted to support the move to help students during the summer to take classes, because I find that they are really asking for that. And that could be, at least in the short term, a great way to help them. And I'd also like to, this drum I've been banging for a while, funding for summer advising. I think that would really help students in the departments.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention on tenure density that it's very difficult for departments to increase their tenure density with a stagnant number of dollars and meet FTES. So that I think that's one of the lines you're bumping up against.
No, that's a good point, and things that we're discussing at Cabinet, because you're right. In fact, we're at the point in many colleges where we've capped out the resources that colleges have in addressing the tenure density challenge, and obviously limiting the lecturer dollars affects our ability to deliver instruction as well. So we have some real work to do there. I agree with you. I think the advising piece, I think it's I guess the way I look at it as, I just don't want to create impediments for students. I don't want to be the ones that tell students what they can and cannot take in the fall semester. I think that's one of the cultural shifts that needs to happen on this campus, and I think many of us have dealt with that. And that is that I think that many of our students can handle 15 units, and I think some of the challenges we have told them many, and I think you can see that just by the numbers, that they can't handle 15 units. Don't take 15 units, and they're told that as a freshman, and they believe it. And they never get back to that 15-unit load ever in their entire time here. And as you can see, just the example that Marna brought up with Monterey Bay, well, guess what? Those students can take 15 units, many of them, that we're telling them that they can't. And they do graduate in 4 years. So we have, I think, a cultural shift in this campus that needs to occur. And that is that our advisors, our faculty, our staff, our administrators need to start having faith that our students can handle a full load of classes here. Because if we continue to tell them that they can't, they're not going to graduate in 4 years. You can't graduate here in 4 years if you take 12 units a semester, unless you do, of course, take summer classes. So I think we have some work to do there, and I scratched my head. I had a long conversation with Maureen. I said, why is our AUL only 12.7? What have we not done? Is it the deans? You know, it's not the deans. I mean, is it the department chairs? What is it? Well, certainly it's the number of classes that our students are taking. So what can we do collectively to address that?
So what do you think?
Yes, let's keep it.
This is a good approach. Special budget presentation. Thank you both. Charlie, fabulous first presentation to the Senate. Thank you. Thank you, Maureen. Thank you very much. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. See you next time.
And the location is just on the page on the top.